So, with the acknowledgement that in the Bible we don't get tons of information about what's next, in Revelation, though, we do get the sense of a new heaven and a new earth.
Mm.
Can you comment on the fact that it seems like Dante leaves out the new earth part?
Yeah. That is almost certainly true. His idea of a soul ascending through the layers of the heavens to come to a confrontation of some kind with the God beyond the heavens. It's not visualizing like resurrection bodies. That's not what the drama of the Divine Comedy is about. He does acknowledge, however, that resurrection bodies are coming. So it's not the story he tells, but in the theology, he explains very clearly that, earlier I said that heaven and hell are eschatological. Those are final states, but purgatory is not on his view. It's not in between the two things. It's a temporary thing that will be entirely folded without remainder into heaven. But in fact, Dante's story isn't taking place in a final state of heaven or hell. He's a pilgrim moving through these zones. And apparently, at the end, he has to wake up and say, oh, it was all a dream. Like, Dante leaves that off camera. Like, Bunyan puts that in. You know, Bunyan has a wake-up scene like, oh, it was all a dream. Amazing. Have you read my book? Dante, that doesn't happen. He gets to the final thing and says, I saw it. I was engaged with that. And you know he must have come back because he wrote the book. But in fact, what's going on in heaven and hell in Dante is these are the intermediate state between now and the resurrection. So I'm trying to think of a proof for that so you don't just have to take my word for it. In the Inferno, there's a scene where he meets people guilty of various levels of violence, and one of those is violence against the self, and one of the forms violence against the self takes is suicide. The suicides in the Inferno are souls hung from the trees of their own bodies. And what's said there is like, but in the day of the last judgment, this is just the Inferno in an intermediate state way. In the day of the last judgment, the souls will go back into the bodies and then they will receive the pronouncement of the final judgment. So kind of a gruesome, dark way to demonstrate it, but should have thought of a happier example. But that's some indication that Dante thinks of his Inferno and Paradiso as intermediate states. Yeah, the afterlife, but not the eschatological state proper. Also, all my examples come from Inferno because I taught it like crazy 2 weeks ago, and it's what's really all in my head. Also, in the Inferno, everyone's complaining about how some of the roads and bridges are broken. Like, they're trying to get certain places. Like, yeah, we have to go around and do a detour because, like, this guy came down and, like, smashed a bunch of stuff and stole a bunch of people. And, like, we're not sure what that was all about, but he's coming back, and then things are going to be really bad after that. It's like, oh, that's as close as they'll come to telling the Jesus story in the Inferno. But apparently he did a raid on hell, and they're like, ah, we're still got that part of the freeway shut down until we can get it rebuilt.
I'm not sure that makes sense, but when you talk about God's greatness without
his yeah.
Is there any sense in which we see that today with the power of technology without God's goodness?
Oh. Yeah, I mean, goodness and greatness are supposed to go together. Certainly in God, they go together. Like at the highest possible, most tightly integrated way, like divine simplicity. The one who is great is the one who is good. But yeah, down here in creation, among finite things, and then certainly among fallen finite things, unfortunately, greatness and goodness are very often at odds with each other. Yeah. The problem of excellent artists who are moral reprobates is like, my dad wasn't much of a theologian, but this puzzled him all the time. Like, he would hear great, he was a country music fan, he would hear awesome country music and be aware of how those people lived and thought, I don't get it. Like, when God was handing out talent, he gave these horrible people the greatest possible voices. Like, how is that possible? And at some level, he was working with this conflict that we experience between greatness and goodness. And you certainly see it in technology, which tries to be end blind, right? Tries to not attend to the purpose of what it's for, but just run the mechanism of, I think we can do this, don't bother asking, should we or why would we do this? We have just learned we can, so obviously we will.
For somebody who has never read the dichotomy and now wants to check out that crazy talking evil, how would you advise them to get started?
Well, that's a good question. So the Divine Comedy makes extreme demands on the attention span. You know, it's a long poem. Once you are able to engage with the rhythm of it, it kind of draws you forward in certain ways. But I would say just make it through once. You know, and just know that you're missing things. There's so much going on in the Divine Comedy. There's a recent book on the Divine Comedy that uses the phrase encyclopedism as a technical phrase for he's trying to show you that he knows everything about everything. And this is because he's in the epic tradition. So going all the way back to Homer, who's the fountainhead of the epic tradition in the West, everyone would read Homer and say, Homer tells stories where someone's weaving, and then someone's cooking, and then someone's like shepherding, and he knows how to do all those things. So like, especially if he's a blind poet, he should only know about words, right? But he seems to know all human endeavors. Like when he describes pottery making, he describes it right. How did he master all of the arts? And so, since everyone's trying to be Homer in the epic tradition, everyone has to have zones in their epic where they show that they know all things. And Dante does that. It's just a little show-offy, but mainly it's just, he'll do an illustration of something and you think, wow, so he also understands, you know, cooking. Point is that when you're reading it, you're always missing something. First couple times I read through it, I thought, okay, this guy knows more about stars than I do. Like there's constellation stuff happening nonstop. He won't tell you it was 3 o'clock. He'll tell you like where the bear was, you know, in the northern quadrant. Like I don't know. I'm just a 21st century guy. I have no idea what he's talking about with this star stuff. So you have to kind of know you're missing stuff, but just power through it and expect to make a return trip. Yeah.
Do you recommend one canto a day or 100 days?
Yeah. I think that's a good option. So you can do that. You can do one canto a day. There are like 100, right? So Baylor Honors College put together this 100 Days of Dante. It's free on YouTube. It's easy to Google your way into. I think I did that when I was teaching Inferno last week. I was really focusing on Canto 17, and I thought, you know, I should. Oh, in my case, I think I should find out how to say Geryon because I have no idea. So, like, I found two different scholars in Canto 16 and 17. Each of them had like a 6-minute video and a 10-minute video. Turns out the Americans say Geryon, and the Italians say Geryon or something like Geryon. Yeah. So I still don't. I just say Geryon. Anyway, so that's a nice series. Several people from Biola Story Honors College got to do videos in that series. I got to do The Gates of Hell and The Vision of the Trinity. So like, I had a friend on the organizing committee, so I got to take my pick. So that's a good option, canto a day. Canto's like 4 pages or something like that. The other thing I would say, though, is since it makes high demands on the attention, once you get into it and kind of are feeling the rhythm of the poetry and you're, it doesn't feel like TV, you know, but it's drawing you along with its own kind of dynamics, it can help to really dig in deeper. So some people might benefit more from more than a half hour in the reading. I say that about like Spenser's Fairy Queen and Shakespeare too. Like once you manage to get over that hurdle and you're into it, like keep at it because there's going to be startup cost. If you set it down and come back the next day, you're going to have that initial startup cost of getting into the rhythm of epic poetry. Yeah. There was one hand back there.
Thank you. Yeah. I was just thinking about your teaching from last night, actually, about Ephesus. And so there's part of God's will is to bring all things in one. It seems like Dante might have a lot to say about how God does that. Hmm. That's one of the
Yeah, that, you know, when I take the step of pointing out what's not in Dante, I always feel a little bit perverse about it. Because the main thing you want to say when Dante lays out this vision is like, wow, that's kind of got everything, right? And so it took me some time to kind of get my mind around the fact that, like, wait, he's not actually talking about certain things that I think need to be here. But there's so much, it's such a banquet, such a feast, there's such a fullness and an apparent comprehensiveness to his poetic vision. Some of that's the greatness of the theology, the traditional theology that he's retailing here. But some of it's just the artistic compactness. Like, he's just a consummate poet and visionary, and he's got a powerful integrating imagination that puts everything together. That's really valuable when we are trying to hear in our fragmented lives and experiences the comprehensiveness of the word that God speaks to us. We're trying to read something like Ephesians and lift ourselves up to an understanding of what's happening there. We could really use tools from anyone who is a master at thinking a large, comprehensive, integrated thought. It's rare, right? We don't run into many people. You meet someone and they tell you something and you think like, wow, you know, I've watched them for a little while and I think they kind of have a vision of the whole, they kind of know where they're at. They know what time it is. They know what they're doing. I've got a friend in theology who, he writes these little tiny articles about little parts of theology, just like, they got handles, you know, they're like, this is just a 9-page article. It's one little argument. Here's how it goes. But you read it and think, he sure is going to get lost in the details, and he never does. They're always like, somehow in his mind, he's got this entire chart of where everything goes, and when he goes in and does subpoint 37B1, it's like, it's right there. And when you take the time to look around and go, oh my gosh, it's all joined up somehow, even though he only worked on this one thing with a good degree of focus, he kind of had a grasp of the whole. And I think that's what we go to great thinkers for. It's specifically what we go to artists for. So this kind of connects to the question earlier about how much imagination would you use to kind of fill in some gaps in your understanding? And my answer there was like, make sure you're flagging it as imagination. You know, like, thus here on the one hand, thus saith the Lord, this is what we have. On the other hand, there's our question of how do we attain to an understanding of the fullness of what God has said? And that's where the arts, I think, are really going to serve us well, right? So can philosophy, so can lots of things, including technology, but like an artistic grasp of a totality is, I think, what Dante really brings.